8. An indecent proposal. Nicola Gobbo becomes informer 3838, 1997 to 2005. The shifting dynamic between Gobbo and Tony Mockbell drives the unusual story of the defence barrister who became a police informer. The pair first met when she worked for Levi Diamond in the late 1990s. She appeared as a witness against Mockbell a few years later. Mockbell was her biggest client. In August 2001, Mockbell was accused of importing more than half a ton of ephedrine to produce $2 billion worth of street drugs. He kept getting rejected for bail until he got a lucky break. Two officers from the former drug squad were charged with trafficking and later convicted. In early 2002, Gobbo walked into Mockbell's maximum security prison and asked him for his business. Barristers don't normally hawk for clients in prisons, but in this case, her moxie paid off. Her specialty was exploiting corruption within the force to get bail for her top clients, and her secretive informer relationship with the ESD's Peter DeSanto, who had charged the two bent cops the previous year, proved handy. She used DeSanto's evidence to successfully argue the case for Mockbell's release. After handing over $1 million in bail money, Mockbell became a free man on Valentine's Day 2002. He kissed Gobbo on the cheek outside court before they streaked away in a black car. Because of ongoing police corruption trials, he didn't face a preliminary hearing until 2005, when Melbourne was steeped in extreme violence over the control of the drug market, leading to plenty more work for Gobbo. Gobbo had been dining weekly with the three other Mockbell brothers to discuss Tony's remand. After he was bailed, she dined with him regularly too. She was part of the Mockbell crew, as she would be part of the Williams crew and the Carlton crew. She was used as camouflage during their criminal discussions to provide confidentiality cover from investigating police. Gobbo was entrenched in the gangland hierarchy long before gangland exploded. She not only liked these men, but she also liked to be liked by them. As eager as she was to please, the pressure from Mockbell was also immense. He compelled her to breach her ethics by employing her to represent his underlings when they got arrested, not to help them, but to ensure that they did not incriminate him. Yet Mockbell, Gobbo would say in 2020, had some redeeming features. He preferred cash and spending it to violence. But he was still a drug baron and, like all drug barons, he didn't play by civilized rules. Violence certainly wasn't a foreign instinct. As he later told Gobbo, he skinned informers alive, along with their children. Gobbo slept in one Saturday in July 2004. She could not shake a headache after waking up. The phone rang. She answered, but she couldn't form words to talk. When she tried getting out of bed, she collapsed. She was hysterical and had no idea what was happening. She sent a text message to get help. Her client and Burnerphone provider, Adam Ahmed, took her to a hospital emergency department where she passed out. When she woke, she learned that she'd had a stroke. A neurologist told her, "I understand you're a barrister. I hope you'll be able to speak again." She was just 31. Any young person who has a stroke shrinks at mortality's brush. They are told facts normally reserved for the old or infirm. Cardiologists and neurologists explain the dynamics of the heart and the brain. In some cases, they test for a congenital heart abnormality known as a patent foramen ovale, PFO. A PFO is a hole between the right and left atriums of the heart that did not seal over properly at birth and allows blood to spill into the head. In young people, it's commonly associated with strokes. About one in four people has PFO, and most of them never know. The condition can be repaired with keyhole surgery, and we know that Gobbo underwent heart surgery. Carl Lyon had PFO surgery in 2011 after a mini-stroke while putting socks on his 18-month-old son. He knows how preoccupying the loss of control can feel. Gobbo regained her speech within 2 days, though she would be permanently plagued with pain in the joint connecting the jaw to the skull. For years, she would take morphine and oxycodone, hillbilly heroin, and would wake some mornings groggy from a range of other heavy-duty medications. Before she got up, she would speak out loud to check that she had not had another stroke in the night. As she would tell The Age in 2008, banks of her memory were erased by the stroke. She was forced to rely on the recollections of her younger sister about her childhood. Every criminal in Melbourne visited her in hospital, including the Mockbell brothers. In a quieter moment, she rang her unofficial police handler, Stuart Bateson. Gangland stopped for no one. Detectives from two different police units considered trying to recruit Gobbo from her hospital bed in 2004. The idea never went anywhere. But it explains the precarious position Gobbo was in during her pre-registration years. She was suspected of legal misdoings at the same time as she was unofficially informing to a succession of detectives. Life-threatening condition or not, she was susceptible to police pressure. The homicide squad compiled a Gobbo profile at about this time. In the brutal language of police officialese, Gobbo was described as solid of build and ruddy of complexion. The report showed considerable insight. It is suspected that Gobbo has detailed knowledge of the affairs of persons like Mockbell and Williams, but is unwilling to tell police exactly what the information she holds is, possibly due to her fear of these identities, the profile read. Another reason is that she will play one side off against the other in order to gain benefit for herself. Gobbo later blamed stress for what had happened to her. "The stroke changed my life," she would say. She later observed that the timing of her stroke could have been fortunate. The medical emergency offered an unexpected way out of her increasingly troubled roles as lawyer and puppeteer, an ideal excuse for her to walk away from all her troubles. No one could dispute a medical impairment. But she didn't walk away. She was back in court within weeks. She was addicted to her double life, even if she suffered for her choices. No one needs a doctor to tell them that death threats heighten anxiety, and there would be dozens over the coming years. We don't know Gobbo's fuller medical history, but we do know extreme anxiety came to disable her. Her neuralgia was exacerbated by tension and uncertainty. She developed stress-related skin lesions and had several hospital stays for concurrent conditions. Fear would nestle as her closest companion. The Hodson killings, just 2 months before her stroke, had rightly unnerved her. When Bezina interviewed her, she told him that she'd received a death threat. Bezina replied that she was amongst it, which he later explained as meaning she was running with the foxes and hunting with the hounds. Gobbo's stroke brought many changes, but it did not soften the demands of her clients. It's unclear when she slept through these years. She met clients late in the evening, yet masqueraded as a conventional barrister during the day. Police surveillance spotted Mockbell and his lawyer in late-night catch-ups. She moved into a Port Melbourne apartment block around the corner from Mockbell's penthouse. The residences shared an underground car park. One day in court, in late 2004, she overheard a police prosecutor speaking of her alleged tryst with Tony Mockbell. She threatened to sue him for defamation. He replied that if she did, he would play the court an audio tape of her having sex with Mockbell. She later denied that they ever spent time overnight in each other's apartments. But choosing to live right near a man whom she derided for the pressures he placed upon her is another puzzling contradiction. Was Gobbo playing at being a full-time spy? More likely, she just liked being close. During this time, Gobbo was telling Stuart Bateson about various gangland heavies and their purported crimes, yet there is nothing to suggest she was informing against her biggest meal ticket, Tony Mockbell. Not yet, anyway. Mockbell's legal woes were an ongoing topic of discussion between lawyer and client. He rang Gobbo multiple times a day. She thought he was a very sensible individual. Something changed from about March 2005. Mockbell began using a new solicitor for his affairs, Zara Gard Wilson. As criminal lawyers, Gobbo and Gard Wilson boasted competing profiles during the gangland years. The women collided often, though Gard Wilson attracted more attention. She was glamorous. Gobbo was not. Gard Wilson frequently posed for photos with her pet snake, Shivus. She'd also been the partner of gangland figure Lewis Kane, who was killed in the back seat of a car. Her name appeared as both a solicitor and defendant at the time. She was a country girl who became a gangland siren. In one of her many magazine profiles, an anonymous source criticized Gard Wilson for crossing accepted lines. The source was Gobbo. Gobbo later claimed that after taking on Gard Wilson, Mockbell went from being reasonable to belligerently fighting back every single thing. He was not relying on Gobbo as he once had. He was listening to someone else who was young and attractive. Gobbo felt sidelined. She would tell the Royal Commission she was concerned about the fact that Mockbell's instructions had become insane. Her client had defected and was listening to someone else. Gobbo had to be wanted and valued and needed by the likes of Tony Mockbell. Her need to shed the Mockbell monkey, as she would call it, appears to have been partly driven by jealousy. That said, there is no doubt she was also increasingly terrified of him. Nothing had changed. 12 months after her stroke, Gobbo was being compelled to make the same unethical choices for Mockbell as she had before her turn. She walked to the Melbourne courts one day, hoping to be hit by a car or tram. Gobbo felt so trapped that she did the unthinkable. Early on the 31st of August 2005, Gobbo rang Detective Senior Constable Paul Rowe and began confessing. Rowe later became a public emblem of anguish due to his involvement in the 2012 murder investigation of Jill Maher. But at this stage, he was part of the Major Drug Investigation Division, MDID. Gobbo rang him out of the blue. Rowe had been investigating a Gobbo client and Mockbell acolyte, Mr. Beautiful, who was charged with and later convicted of trafficking ecstasy. She and Rowe were due to appear on opposing sides of the courtroom later that morning. Rowe knew Gobbo's reputation. His boss, Jim O'Brien, had received complaints from his subordinates about her behaviour. O'Brien had considered trying to tap her phone. The MDID suspected that she represented Mockbell's associates on Mockbell's orders to ensure they didn't roll on him to police. Putting her client's interests behind Mockbell's invited questions of perverting the course of justice. Such lawyer misconduct is criminal. Gobbo's phone call, Rowe later agreed, was quite extraordinary. She confirmed that police suspicions were well placed, but didn't go far enough. She admitted she was not acting in the best interests of Mr. Beautiful and other underlings to protect Tony Mockbell. In effect, that she was running a protection racket for a drug baron. She had read Mr. Beautiful's record of interview with police. Mockbell was named in it. She would be imperiled as Mockbell's legal fixer if the mention came out in court and Mockbell heard about it. Mr. Beautiful, a handsome man on whom Gobbo later became fixated, would be forced to take the fall because Mockbell had terrified Gobbo into submission. Roe agreed to meet Gobbo at the Melbourne Magistrates Court that morning. Superiors, including O'Brien, advised him to record the conversation. A tape of Gobbo's claims would amount to an admission of guilt. Tears rolling down her cheeks, Gobbo spoke to Roe for 5 minutes or less. People walked past, including Gobbo's close colleagues, unaware that this odd exchange would transform the gangland war and lead to a royal commission. In the course of those 5 minutes, Gobbo confirmed that she regularly gathered information for Mokbel's benefit under duress to the detriment of his associates. The fact that lines were being blurred is not a massive surprise, Roe would tell the Royal Commission in 2019. But the fact that Gobbo was telling him was an unbelievably unexpected situation. She was just really stressed, Roe emphasized. Just under enormous pressure. You could see it on her face as she spoke. Gobbo sought a hand of friendship. She didn't want to represent Mokbel's associate that day in court. She was 100% looking for a way out of that environment, Roe claimed. So the police made her an offer. Roe agreed to meet Gobbo again later that same day. He and his superior officer, Detective Sergeant Steve Mansell, took Gobbo for a drive around Footscray Market. The conversation was again recorded and lasted about an hour. Gobbo told Roe and Mansell that most of Mokbel's assets were concealed and that he laundered money. She talked and they listened, in what played out like a counselling session. Gobbo was admitting wrongdoing, but she wanted help from police in return for her candour. She did not want to walk away from her criminal law career. It wasn't an option. She wanted to be rid of Tony Mokbel without losing her business or her name, or suffering a more dramatic fate, so she sought a solution that no defence lawyer should consider. She was uniquely placed to feed police information that would implicate Mokbel. All she had to do was breach her professional ethics and hide her betrayals, lest she be killed for her deception. Gobbo was willing to play both sides. She had done so since 1995 with a string of police officers, from Tim Argall to Stuart Bateson, and she would do so for the rest of her legal career. The detectives made their pitch. Mansell invited her to get on board, that is, to become a police informer, for what would be the third time, unaware that she had already been informing, officially and unofficially, for a decade. She grasped the risks. "If anyone finds out about this, I will be murdered," she said. Mansell agreed. Yes, the arrangement would have to be managed carefully. Legal considerations were not discussed. A defence barrister who was also an informer was an obvious challenge. "It's not like we had to articulate it to each other," Roe would say in 2019. He admitted that he viewed the chat as a disclosure about a crime, not the pivot for an unprecedented relationship that ran the risk of tainting every conviction it brought about. How could the force possibly ignore information that indicted drug traffickers? Damned if they did, damned if they didn't. Roe has since dismissed any idea that Gobbo's coming forward was a grand scheme to embark on an informing career. But he didn't know her informer history, and no one checked. For Gobbo, the only fix for feeling low was more danger. She yearned for the attention and the power of providing secret information. It made her feel important. Gobbo later likened this era of her informing to community service. Yet she wasn't inspired by a desire to clean the streets. Her choices were driven by self-preservation. She could see no other way except playing both sides. As she once told her client Terry Hodson, "When you're walking on a tightrope, the only way to stop from falling is to play both sides against the middle." But was there even more to it than that? Gobbo had privately decided to help police 12 months earlier when she'd started informing unofficially to Bateson. He followed Argyll, Strawhorn, Pope, and DeSanto. In 2020, Gobbo would describe her informal registration in 2005 as inevitable. It had been a question of when, not if. Bateson's Piranha superior, Inspector Gavin Ryan, had been suspicious when his detective began speaking to Gobbo at the end of 2003. Ryan had wondered if Gobbo was seeking to be a double agent for the criminals and briefly put her under police surveillance at about the start of 2004. His concerns were shared by the head of the Ethical Standards Department, Superintendent Stephen Fontana. In labelling her as unreliable, Fontana joined a growing list of senior police officers who had condemned Gobbo's use. The doubters had included Senior Sergeant Jack Blaney in 1995 and Detective Senior Constable Chris Lim in 1998. By 2010, they included the Deputy Chief Commissioner, Sir Ken Jones. On the 16th of September 2005, 2 weeks after she first phoned Roe, Gobbo went on another drive with Rowan Mansell. She was meeting Senior Sergeant Sandy White and one of his subordinates, Peter Smith. White was the head of the newly formed Source Development Unit, SDU, which handled high-risk informers. The unit was established as a direct consequence of the Hodson killings, the latest tragedy in the blighted history of Victoria Police's informer management. The woman who played the circus ringleader in the lead-up to the Hodson deaths, Nicola Gobbo, was about to become the SDU's first big recruit. The car made left and right turns through the tree-lined streets of Middle Park, a pocket of Melbourne preferred by wealthy barristers, including Gobbo at one time prior. The two officers kept their eyes on the side and rear-view mirrors to ensure they were not being followed as they passed the Victorian-era houses with their elaborate lead-light windows. As the car snaked the few kilometres to Southbank, where new apartment high-rises blocked the light, Roe and Mansell told Gobbo they were being deliberately cautious. They said to me it was for my own safety, so that they could ascertain that I wasn't being followed. Gobbo would tell a closed courtroom in 2017. But I also thought that it was because they wanted to make sure I wasn't setting them up. She felt sick in the stomach. It's all this build-up to, we're going to pick you up and take you somewhere safe. No one will see. You've got to not be followed. And yet we ended up in a building about 30 metres from where Tony Mockbell was living, she said. The SDU was an elite, highly secretive unit made up of officers ranked sergeant or above. They used police jargon about sterile corridors, protecting the source's identity from police investigators, and the delightfully oxymoronic partial sterile corridors. Sandy White would later be decorated for his work with an Australian Police Medal. He was old school, a cop for more than three decades, the kind who Gobbo suspected had few interests outside of the police force. White's dedication to his work, like Gobbo's previous handlers, inspired her misplaced need to impress him. Her meeting with White and Smith took place in a hotel room opposite the Herald Sun offices on City Road. Gobbo declined offers of tea, coffee, and red wine. She offered White a potted summary of her unofficial assistance to Victoria Police in the past. She explained that she had been in grave danger for a long time. You need to trust us fully, but we cannot entirely trust you because of the nature of the relationship, White told Gobbo. Trust is something that is earned. The terms of engagement they struck sound naive now, almost wistful. The linchpins of their unholy agreement would be shattered within months. For White and his superiors, a noble end justified an indecent proposal. Gobbo did not want the meeting recorded because she knew physical evidence could expose her in a courtroom. White told her their conversation wouldn't be taped, but he lied. He had already pressed the record button. He told her she would never be called as a witness, a major career hurdle for a defense barrister and deadly for a police informer. But he was wrong. Later, she was called as a witness. He said her intelligence would be shared within Victoria Police without her being identified. Yet she would be identified again and again when her information was passed to investigators. White said police reports relating to her informing could be hidden from judicial processes. It would be their little secret. Gobbo was supposedly being offered an invisible cloak to hide her informing from the criminals and the justice system. Yet she stood to be disrobed again and again. White told her that Victoria Police would claim PII, or public interest immunity, to conceal her identity in legal documents. PII is a life and death measure judges grapple with all the time. Police often claim PII to protect their informers' identities. In criminal cases, judges must weigh up the exposure of a source's name and subsequent risk of harm against the need for an open trial. Gobbo grasped PII because she had fought for the right to see confidential documents protected by PII as a defense lawyer on behalf of clients. She knew that PII was hardly fail-safe, especially when the same informer repeatedly gave police information. She herself had figured out Terry Hodson's double agent role when his informer number kept appearing in court documents. From the beginning, Gobbo had no illusions, yet she still went ahead with it. She was wedded to her double life, in part because she could see no other way, but also because she thirsted for the excitement. "If this gets out, say nice things at my eulogy, because I will be gone, and enjoy the Royal Commission," she said. She was given informer number 3838. Whispers endure, though it seems unlikely, that the designation was a lewd reference to her bust size. Within days, Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland and a subordinate, Superintendent Tony Biggin, met to discuss their new recruit. Again, there is no evidence that the question of ethics was raised in the meeting. Gobbo was to be used as a release valve, dampening the political pressure police were under to solve gangland crimes. Both lawyers by training, Overland and Gobbo, never met, despite widespread claims of clandestine chats. Yet she would become his secret weapon, a kind of Jason Bourne who would eventually turn on the power that built and then discarded her. Gobbo generated 5 slabs of invaluable intelligence at that first meeting with White and Smith. Her fears drenched the discussion. She was worried about having another stroke at this rate. Yet in the first 3 months after Informer 3838 was registered, police completed 183 reports based on her information, almost 2 a day, every day. Sandy White had travelled to Britain and Canada to research informer models and protocols. He took pride in his unit as a new and better way. Everything was recorded, if hidden from scrutiny at the time. Between 2005 and 2009, she had more than 100 meetings with her handlers that were recorded on audio tapes. Her handlers took notes during her constant phone calls, which were summarized as information contact reports. The SDU was a one-off. So was Gobbo. Urgent intelligence was assessed and disseminated immediately as so-called hot briefs. Because she produced so much information, some of her handlers got months behind writing up the reports. Who could blame them? The pace was frenetic. Gobbo didn't stop. No detail appeared to defy her gaze. She was a brain box of facts and observations. One Gobbo information report even described another lawyer as sporting a $2,500 Versace tracksuit. Gobbo would spend hours on the phone with handlers, who were rotated like frontline soldiers for rest breaks. Their official jottings would be as telling for what they did not say as what they did. How Gobbo got her information was often glossed over, as if her handlers did not know or did not care to know. Did she wear a hairpin wire, as rumoured, for pillow talk? It sounds far-fetched, but police records do not say. Gobbo provided far more than drug lab sites and phone numbers. She told police who was fighting who and why. She identified the weak links to exploit. Her dedication scuttled any pretense of client loyalty or confidentiality. Yet it seems likely that Gobbo's information flow went both ways, to the cops and to the criminals. It had to, otherwise Gobbo would have been killed. She built trust through sharing information with police. It makes sense that she also ingratiated herself with criminals by alerting them to police targets and activities. Police had already expressed fears that Gobbo, the police informer, could, in fact, become Gobbo the double agent working for the baddies. White was wary of giving her information she did not need to know. Yet she spoke directly at times to Piranha investigators so that her informer activities were not mistaken for conspiring to commit crimes. Gobbo would call her handlers up to 9 times a day from her secret phone dedicated to this purpose. Her bat phone lived in her handbag. Sometimes she ended calls abruptly because the mark of her informing had turned up for coffee or a drink. These calls produced the information reports that are Gobbo's story, as told to the police who listened, cajoled, and tasked her. Nicola Gobbo was spring-loaded with ideas on the day she arrived for her first meeting with White and Smith. She'd given the role a lot of thought over many months. She'd wanted to jail her biggest client and chief irritant, Tony Mockbell, for a long time. Victoria Police wanted Mockbell badly. He was the Teflon-coated white whale, the smart-ass who dismissed detectives as Muppets. One of White's first requests at this initial meeting in the hotel room was, "Tell me everything you know about Tony Mockbell." So she did, with a preamble. Her relationship with Mockbell and her betrayal of him would make the greatest story, she suggested. "That's the book we're never going to write," Smith replied. Gobbo described Tony Mockbell's sense of invincibility. 3838 believes nothing will ever happen to Mockbell because everyone knows that if you kill Tony, the brothers will kill you, the handler's report read. It would be fantastic, she explained, if police arrested Mockbell, but the charges had to be so serious that he couldn't get bail. He's not going to fight a trial from within custody because his access to be able to speak to people is massively cut off, she told her handlers. I mean, you will monitor every call, every visit. He'll be in a high security unit, presumably. He would plead. Things would change. God, it would relieve so much pressure off me. The last sentence is telling, put paid to her later claims of altruism. 5 minutes later, her handlers deferred to her sense of importance. They admitted that Gobbo knew far more about Mockbell's criminality than they could. Only the day before, she told them, Mockbell had decided he might bribe police officers. He thinks all police officers are a joke. He continually tries to make you think he's got police in the back pocket. Continuously. Gobbo was a talking catalogue of Mockbell's criminal history. He ate too much when he was stressed. He thought he was Tony Soprano. Without Gobbo, how would police know that Milad Mockbell was sleeping with the sister of a police officer and getting confidential information from his lover? Gobbo spoke to Tony Mockbell almost every day and dutifully reported details of each conversation to her handlers. She billed Mockbell for it too, $84,000 in legal fees over the 4 months until March 2006. The chasm between Gobbo's distaste for a target and her shows of subjugation to them was most gaping in the case of Mockbell. Police wondered at the continued late-night catch-ups between the pair, as well as Gobbo's ongoing protection of the Lord Mayor at the legal expense of his acolytes. As much as ever, she was one of Mockbell's crew. Yet Gobbo despised him by now. Tony Mockbell is basically stupid and doesn't listen to 3838 advice, her handlers later wrote. Example? He was summonsed to the ATO, Australian Tax Office. 3838 told him not to answer questions, but he said, "No, they're all idiots," answered questions, and now he has been hit with a tax bill of $4.5 million. On her very first day as an informer, Gobbo floated the perfect way to nab Mockbell. One of Mockbell's crew, she said, could have sold all of them out, put everyone in jail for a long time. But he hadn't. Perhaps he would, Gobbo suggested, with a push. A police operation, posse, relied almost entirely on her insights. It sought to marginalise the Mockbells and disrupt their associates. Detectives heeded her advice and fingered this crew member as the wobbly link in the criminal chain of control. And when this link broke, it would scuttle the Mockbell empire.